Listen local.
Live from the WJFF studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, could Pennsylvania's fracking wastewater hold the key to the country's energy transition? The U.S. will need a lot more lithium to make the energy transition from fossil fuels to renewables, and Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale has a ton of it. We'll speak with WHYY News Climate Desk reporter Susan Phillips about how Pennsylvania could become a massive contributor to the country's quest for lithium after scientists discovered a large reservoir of the chemical element in fracking wastewater. The Hound of the Baskervilles kicks off Shadowland Stage's 2024 season. The story follows Sherlock Holmes, accompanied by the ever-loyal Dr. Watson, this time played by Jessica Lopez Markle. We'll chat with her about this update of the Arthur Conan Doyle detective series. Plus, two local Girl Scouts on a mission of peace. But first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. The criminal hush money case against former President Donald Trump is about to go to the jury. The panel is returning to the courtroom at this hour to receive instructions from the judge in the case before jurors are sent out to begin deliberations. NPR's Andrea Bernstein reports the jury will be tasked with reaching a verdict in the first criminal case against a former American president.
The defense went first, saying Trump did not have sex with Stormy Daniels, did have a retainer agreement with Michael Cohen, and that there was no proof that Trump signed off on the scheme other than Cohen, a convicted liar. But prosecutors spent 6 hours going through testimony of other witnesses, including Trump supporter and former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker, who said he discussed hush money with Trump. The DA laid out scores of phone records showing calls from Cohen around key moments in the Stormy Daniels payment scheme. They also presented two records they called smoking guns, notes written on Cohen's bank statement for the $130,000 hush money payment about reimbursement for Cohen, calling it a legal expense. Andrea Bernstein, NPR News, New York.
The Democratic National Committee says it will nominate President Biden through a virtual roll call vote before the August convention. The move will ensure that Biden will appear on the November ballot in Ohio, a critical swing state. Ohio's Republican Secretary of State has warned that Biden would not be on the state's ballot unless lawmakers move the ballot access deadline to meet state requirements. The DNC is planning to hold its nominating convention in Chicago the week of August 19th. Stocks on Wall Street opened sharply lower this morning amid news of another big merger in the oil patch. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell by about 330 points in early trading.
ConocoPhillips is buying Marathon Oil for just over $17 billion in stock. ConocoPhillips will also assume nearly $5.5 billion in Marathon debt. That's a premium price for Marathon, and the company's shares traded higher as a result. The deal is expected to close later this year. Crude oil prices opened up while retail gasoline prices dipped slightly. Stock in American Airlines lost some altitude after the company lowered its spring profit forecast. The news also caused turbulence for stock in other airlines, including Delta and Southwest. Dick's Sporting Goods, on the other hand, raised its forecast for sales and profit this year, and investors reacted positively. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks continue to take lower on Wall Street at this hour. The Dow was down 321 points, the Nasdaq down 97, the S&P 500 down 34 points. This is NPR News. Major League Baseball is set to announce today that it will incorporate the statistics of Negro League players in its record book. The additions will drastically change some of baseball's most historic accomplishments. Center fielder Ty Cobb has held a record 367 career batting average for nearly a century. That record will now be held by Negro League player Josh Gibson with his mark of 372. There's a new Banksy Museum in New York City, except the works there aren't actually Banksy's. NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento reports.
For decades, the anonymous artist Banksy has upended the art world with his subversive murals that appear suddenly overnight. Now a museum in New York is featuring 160 replicas of those works without Banksy's permission. Museum founder Aziz Vardar sees it as a kind of preservation of Banksy's pieces. But the company that manages Banksy's licensing has denounced any use of his art for profit on its website. So even though Banksy wrote in his book that copyright is for losers,
he automatically had a copyright when he created this artwork. The fact that he doesn't like copyright doesn't really make a difference.
Arts and intellectual property attorney Leila Aminadole says the artist could still have a legal case against the museum. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News.
Two giant pandas will return to Washington's National Zoo by the end of the year. The zoo made the announcement today, about a year and a half after it sent three pandas back to China. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include TimberTech, transforming landfill-bound waste into sustainable PVC and composite outdoor decking products designed to look like real wood. More at TimberTech.com. Everything wood should be.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Scientists have uncovered a massive untapped reservoir of lithium in wastewater from Pennsylvania's natural gas fracking sites. It's a finding that could help meet surging demand for this vital battery material. The researchers, publishing their work in the journal Scientific Reports, estimate the wastewater contains enough lithium to supply up to 40% of U.S. demand. I spoke with Philadelphia's WHYY News Climate Desk reporter Susan Phillips about how Pennsylvania could become a huge contributor to the country's quest for lithium after scientists discovered this large reservoir of the chemical element in the fracking wastewater in the Marcellus Shale. Can you tell us a little bit about how this lithium was discovered in Pennsylvania's fracking wastewater?
Sure. So the researcher, his name is Justin Mackey. He had been working as a consultant for the gas industry in Pennsylvania about half a dozen years ago. And he wondered, you know, as a part of his consultancy, I guess he was testing what was in this wastewater that comes back up a well. And just want to make clear that this is not the frack water that's injected into the well necessarily, but this really salty brine that exists deep within the Marcellus Shale and has been there for thousands, millions of years and comes back up with the gas. And so the gas industry has a problem as to what to do with this water. But one of the things Pennsylvania requires is testing of the water and testing for certain elements, certain toxins, and for whatever reason they test for lithium. And so he decided to get all of that data from the state. I think it was over 600 reports that he got. And he found that especially in north central northeast Pennsylvania, the water that comes up has a lot of lithium in it. So, you know, I think what he found was that the lithium that is within this wastewater, which the industry calls produced water, could provide 38 to 40% of the current domestic demand for lithium.
Just to put that into perspective, the majority of lithium in the world is produced in Australia, Chile, and China. They currently produce 90% of the world's lithium. And with all this increased demand, this could really be a game changer. How could the discovery of the lithium in the produced water from the shale impact the future of, for example, electric vehicle battery production in the U.S.?
Well, I mean, that's a big question, right? I mean, one of the things that the U.S. is worried about is the fact that a lot of these lithium ion batteries are coming from China. And just to be clear, the majority of the lithium is actually mined in Chile and Argentina and also Australia, but it's all sent to China to be processed. Mm-hmm. And then it comes back here. And one of the things that makes lithium so good as a battery is that it's very light, but it also, you know, can store a lot of energy. So that's why we've seen the lithium iron battery kind of become the go-to battery for EV vehicles, for instance. And the Biden administration wants to make sure that there's, you know, a domestic supply of this, and he's, you know, put incentives to make sure that that happens. But, you know, the demand, just to put it in perspective, right now the demand is estimated at 3,000 metric tons a year, but that demand is expected to jump to 340,000 metric tons by 2032 as we see more and more electric vehicle development and other things that just need these types of batteries.
So, you know, we want to transition to electric vehicles. The Biden administration doesn't want you to transition to those produced in China, but that's a good thing, transition to EVs. It sounds as if taking this lithium in this fracking water and extracting the lithium from it, could that also be a good thing, or are there also other impacts there as well?
Well, if you talk to the researchers, I guess there are people that would have different opinions about this. I mean, actually, when I kind of reached out to a lot of environmentalists, they were sort of hesitant because they hadn't really looked into this issue. But it is sort of ironic that, you know, we're using a waste product from fossil fuel extraction to then help us with the transition, theoretically. I mean, I think when I asked the researchers that question, I mean, one of the things they said was, look, you know, we wouldn't advocate drilling for lithium, but if we're already drilling for oil and gas and this wastewater is coming up and it's already filled with lithium, that it makes sense for us to use this domestic supply. And, you know, one of the things I also want to say, like, there is a specific lithium mine that's being developed in Arkansas, where that's exactly what they're doing, is they are drilling for the brine water to extract the lithium.
But extracting lithium from the wastewater that's already there, also not easy. It requires a lot of energy.
Right, exactly. And of course, that's an issue. I mean, right now, the way a lot of lithium is through hard rock mining, right, which is bad in a number of reasons, but also it's highly energy intensive. And we do that in Nevada right now. Also, the issues with sort of extracting it from brine in places like Chile in the Atacama Desert is that, you know, these are areas that don't have a lot of water anyway. So there's fear that it would just, you know, sort of deplete this desert area of water itself.
And also, once you extract lithium from that wastewater, there's still remaining wastewater, and that also needs to be disposed of.
Exactly. And, you know, that's the thing. There's a lot of other really bad things in this wastewater, right, like benzene and toluene, cancerous, you know, materials. So what we're doing now is we re-inject that wastewater back into the well to produce more natural gas, right? It's just basically used to frack the well again, or at least in the case of Pennsylvania, we don't have a lot of deep injection wells. So what they do is they ship it primarily to Ohio, which does have a lot of injection wells, and then they inject it back down deep into the formation, and that's how they dispose of it.
I wanted to ask you about the company Eureka Resources that already operates in the Marcellus Shale. They say they've already developing a process to extract lithium from the wastewater. Can you tell us about the Eureka Resources company?
Yes, Eureka Resources is actually a wastewater treatment company. So they have two wastewater treatment plants in Pennsylvania where they treat frack water. I mean, that's the other way you can do it. You can take this wastewater and basically extract a lot of the bad stuff out of it, and it becomes sort of this solid brick. And then the rest of the water, you know, it's clean enough to use, but then you would still have to dispose of the solid waste that you have extracted from it, which it contains a lot of salts. But yes, yeah, so this company says that it has already been extracting lithium out of the water, and they say they have a process to do this, and that, you know, it's been very successful. But other than that, I don't know much more about it, other than, you know, the information I was able to read that they released.
What are some of the economic benefits of this discovery?
Well, you know, I think for the industry, lithium is highly valuable, and so much so that, you know, ExxonMobil has invested heavily in lithium production in Arkansas, what's called the Smackover Formation, which, you know, is similar to Marcellus in that it had been an oil and gas field, and it's a brine. There's a lot of brine, salty brine that's still deep within the earth that they're extracting, and then extracting the lithium from that.
What's the response from the state? How are they approaching this discovery?
Yeah, so this was a report from the federal government, actually, the Department of Energy. So I'm not sure what the state is planning or doing, but the information, the raw data came from the state, but it was the Department of Energy that, you know, funded this research. So I think the DOE is very much interested in finding more domestic sources of lithium. And I think, I mean, from talking to a couple of people, they were surprised at just how much lithium was in this water, but also that, you know, it's not an easy process to get the lithium out. And it's not as if oil and gas companies, you know, typically do this. So Eureka Resources is the only one I could find that says they have a process to do this. But, at this point, it's unclear, you know, what the path forward is. I think this sort of initial research is out there, and then it'll be interesting to see how different people respond to it.
Definitely ironic to have the wastewater brine and then suddenly could potentially become something environmentally useful, I guess.
You know, at this point, I think it's kind of ironic, right?
Yeah.
That you would have, oil and gas production of a sort of toxic wastewater that contains this very crucial element to the energy transition and getting us off fossil fuels. It would be interesting to see how these environmental groups think of this, because it is an issue. It's always an issue, no matter what kind of energy you use. There are going to be drawbacks to it. But I think what the researchers are saying here is that, you know, if we already have this water and we already have to do something with it, we might as well make use of the lithium that's in there and help us with the transition away from fossil fuels. And just to be clear, it's unclear for me. I mean, I talked to a lot of people, but it was unclear how economically feasible extracting lithium is from Marcellus Shale right now. I mean, obviously, it's highly valuable, but it's unclear how much that would cost to do. So, you know, there's a lot of sort of open questions right now.
Susan Phillips from WHYY, WHYY's News Climate Desk. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, The Hound of the Baskervilles. It's the third of the four crime novels by British writer Arthur Conan Doyle, featuring the detective Sherlock Holmes. The play of The Hound of the Baskervilles kicks off Shadowland Stage's season and features a twist on the character of Dr. Watson, Sherlock's loyal sidekick. We'll tell you about it next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hi, it's Rosie Starr, host of Farm and Country. Join us Saturdays at 10 a.m. on Radio Catskill for stories about rural life in the Catskills and the Delaware River Valley. Feed your ears some good radio produce. Listen local.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Shadowland Stages is kicking off its 2024 season with the comedy The Hound of the Baskervilles, adapted from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tale, adapted by Stephen Canny and John Nicholson. The play opens Friday and runs through June 16th at Shadowland Stages' Main Stage Theater, located on Canal Street in Ellenville. The story follows the detective, Sherlock Holmes, portrayed by Michael Frederick in this production, and accompanied by the ever-loyal Dr. Watson, played by Jessica Lopez Barkle in this production, as they investigate the mysterious death of Sir Charles Baskerville. On the phone with us now to tell us more is Jessica Lopez Barkle. She's also the theater program director, a professor at SUNY Sullivan, and a playwright and designer. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. I want to ask you a lot about this twist on the character of Dr. Watson. But first, I wanted to just ask you about some news that was announced recently. SUNY Sullivan cutting some programs at the college, including the Theater Associate of Arts program, which you headed. Can you tell us about that, what happened, and what does that mean for you and the students?
For me and the students, it means that I can teach out the program of the majors that are still there. They have that right. So I will be finishing their time there so they can finish their degree. At that point, it's a little unclear as to how the theater aspects of the college will continue. What was published by the VP of Academics or our provost, Rose Hanafy, was that there will still be a theater club and that the classes could continue as electives. I am a tenured professor and I have taught many types of classes. So there are classes I can teach, so I will continue to teach. But it is a little bit unclear to me at this point how productions might move forward. Those are the facts that I know.
Yeah. Well, according to the report in the Sullivan County Democrat, at the meeting, a majority of the comments from public were in support of the theater program and in support of you specifically. And Dr. Teresa Hamlin, a vice chair of the Board of Trustees, is quoted as saying, quote, everyone needs to understand that we're in support of keeping theater here and still having productions. We just can't afford to keep the formal AA degree in theater, but we can keep theater as part of this community and part of this college. That's important to all of us on the board, end quote. So we'll wait to see what happens. In the meantime, you're keeping busy as the theater program director at Shadowlands Main Stage Theater and co-starring in it as Dr. Watson. It's not the first time that there's been a female version of Dr. Watson. There was that series Elementary on CBS a few years ago. Lucy Liu portrayed the female Dr. Watson. Can you tell us about why you guys decided to make Dr. Watson female in this production?
I don't get to make those decisions, but I am honored that Brendan Burke, the director and artistic director of Shadowland Stages, has enough faith in me to let me interpret Dr. Watson in sort of a gender bending but ambiguous interpretation of Dr. Watson. I'm dressed up as a man, but we're not trying to hide my voice. We're not trying to change that there is some ambiguous sexual innuendos in the production. those have lived throughout many of the productions and films and television series is never explained, but more clear in the one that had Lucy Liu. But I think it's fun. Dr. Watson is this part of this odd man, Sherlock Holmes, and is the one that can connect with him and the one that he sticks with the longest. And they're sparring partners in a strange way. It is a weird relationship, a weird friendship marriage almost. And so I think it leans into the ability to put any gender on it.
Is that how it's being played then, as any gender? Or is it specifically you're playing the role as a woman?
I'm playing it as Watson, and I'm not trying to be male or female. I'm just Watson who's being caught up in this wild story. I think I'm obviously female, and then but dressed up in the bowler hat and the suit and the tweed. And then there is relationships with the two men on stage, you know? So, I think we're just playing with that ambiguity and having fun with that humor. I mean, it's a very funny play. And Watson, the other kind of strange twist on this particular production of Watson is that he's almost like a Buster Keaton character. He's being thrust into sort of crazy environments, and he's not necessarily the one who like figures everything out right away, but in that particular novel, it is from his perspective. So he is kind of the protagonist, and he is telling the story first person in that novel. And so he's experiencing it in the moment, which is a lot of fun to play because you get to watch all the wild happenings going on. It was definitely created by a clown company, and Watson is mostly the straight man, but he's a straight man who isn't trying to make anything happen. Things happen to him. Things happen around him.
Well, and as I mentioned in the introduction, this version, the play version of The Hound of the Baskervilles is a comedy. So you're mentioning some of the comedic aspects of it. And I'm just wondering with some of the ambiguity of Dr. Watson being played by you and some of the things you mentioned, does that increase the comedic value in some ways or make it different?
I think it does. I mean, we'll see when the audience gets there. But I mean, I have a couple of moments that are really hard not to break. You know,
have you broken in the rehearsal?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We all have.
How much did you research the original Dr. Watson and also this novel and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and all of the Sherlock lore?
You know, it's not my first Sherlock play. I've done another one, so I've had taken a deep dive before. I was a big fan of the novels when I was a kid. I watched all of the Sherlock with Martin Freeman, Benedict Cumberbatch, and I've watched a lot of the Lucy Liu one. The name is escaping me right now.
Elementary.
There it is. And you know, I took on this role and I watched the 1939 film, which is wonderful because there's also apparently this production is very much inspired by that one. And it's also kind of a good mystery. It's a good scary movie, almost the play. It's a scary movie juxtaposed with humor. And, you know, it also does what I think live theater should do. You're watching what live actors can do well. And we play many roles. We switch costumes, we run around, you see us play with different accents, different, you know, areas. We do everything. We move the set pieces, we have the props, we mime, you know. So you get to see us do a lot of what is meta theatrical and fun to watch that, you know, isn't necessarily as entertaining on a film. And so it's really important to me as somebody who's always training emerging artists to make sure that we see that clear juxtaposition between what our different adjacent art forms do well. And in this one, this is a very live presentational performance with amazing acting at the same time. I mean, I'm not saying that's not me having ego or anything, but just like, I'm in awe of my fellow actors in this show. You know, I'm like the straight man, but like, I just love Michael and Paul so much. They're so funny.
tell me about Michael and Paul, the other actors in the show. Michael playing Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, Michael's playing Sherlock Holmes amongst many other roles. And I have to say his Miss Stapleton is my favorite role of his. it's please come and see it if you're listening. His Miss Stapleton is not to be missed. Paul is playing Sir Henry Baskerville, which is the man that we're coming to try to protect. That's the case that we have taken, and he's a Canadian, and he's just sort of like caught up in this wild thing. He's inherited this land after his uncle has died, and you know, we don't know why, and there's a scary dog, you know, of lore or reality, not so sure, you know. So all of that is a lot of fun, and Paul also plays several other roles on top of that.
So are there just the three of you in the play playing multiple roles?
Yeah,
oh, well, that's got to be fun.
All of the characters.
That's got to be fun. Like, you're just seeing, for the audience as well, seeing the different change-ups. And then I can imagine how having these probably quick changes and seeing your fellow actors in different roles very quickly could lead to more obvious times where you might lose it on stage a little bit.
Yeah. In the last season, I did 39 steps, which was in a similar vein. And running around, playing so many different characters and the specificity and the costumes and trying to do that well and sharp and not messy, not muddling it up. It's what we do is difficult.
What's
fun.
Yeah. What's been the sort of the most enjoyable part of the process so far for you?
I think, this sounds a bit self-serving, but it was nice to, be able to go and do a really fun show after the past 2 months really kind of fighting for the theater program at SUNY Sullivan, and being able to just, hold my head high and still say, I'm really proud of this community. I'm proud of the live theater tradition that it does in its small and amazing and professional status with Shadowland Stages, Forest Park Playhouse, Farm Arts Collective, NACL Theater, so many others. And I'm so proud of this community. So it was nice to just be I'm an equity actor in this community who does also work. And I was a big believer in the program that I started in 2014. So my heart was broken, but being able to kind of jump into a silly play has been really nice.
Yeah. Well, I imagine that it was great to hear from all of those folks that you just mentioned coming out to support you and that program and that community supporting theater in this area. I mean, I've always remarked about how rich we have it in terms of arts and theater specifically. There's so many organizations, troops. The new one just opened up, I guess, recently as well. It's just such a magnet for folks of being creative, and that's got to be satisfying for you there at Shadowland. What else is going on at Shadowland that you want folks to know about?
I mean, their season is a lot of fun this year, and then there's some newer pieces that will be coming in toward the fall. I think that there might have been a little bit of misinformation. I'm not the theater program director there.
Sorry. That was my misreading of, sorry.
That's okay. But I'm a big fan of that whole theater. So I pay attention, and I'm a big fan of all of my cohorts that are here. I've made friends with everyone in this community for the past 10 years. So, and yes, I was enormously humbled and, gracious, and just my heart, I can't say how much I loved how much support came out for that program last Thursday. So, and because I think it's because we all do care so much about one another.
Yeah. And, talking about how much the community cares for each other and how much you care for this particular place, Shadowland Stages, you mentioned that you were in 39 Steps before. And what does Shadowland mean for you as a place to go and another venue to perform?
Yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful space. It's the board of trustees there are the board of directors. I don't know if it's trustees or directors, but they're so involved. It's so amazing to see. They always have a breakfast for the actors. They're so last night their board president was in the back, and he had driven to Delaware to go get the playbills, and he always helps. I've never seen such hands-on. That is Ellenville is a true community that people should really just embrace, because, despite all of our upstate issues that we have, there are people who believe in our communities, and they believe that a cultural aspect to them brings potential back to everything. And Ellenville does that with their theater and their connections with their restaurants and, any of their events that they do for parades. They're all connected. They all know each other. They all work really hard. And I think that that's an amazing thing to see.
The Hound of the Baskervilles opens Friday at the main stage in Ellenville. Nervous, excited? How are you feeling?
Both. I think any actor would say, especially when there's three people that are reliant on the entire storytelling and everything, that you have nothing else except each other to rely on and have a lot of fun. But we've got a great design team. We've got a great stage management team. I think all of it, Brendan at the helm, Brittany as the managing director, that whole team is amazing.
All right. There's more information about the Hound of the Baskervilles and Shadowland Stages 2024 season at shadowlandstages.org. We've been speaking to Jessica Lopez Barkle, who plays the ever loyal Dr. Watson in the comedic play adaptation of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's classic tale about Sherlock Holmes. Jessica, thank you so much for joining us. Break a leg.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
All right, we'll take a break, and when we come back, the Summer Song Swap. We'll tell you about it. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, independent grassroots global news. Our reporting includes breaking daily news headlines and in-depth interviews with people on the front lines of the world's most pressing issues. People speaking for themselves, providing unique and sometimes provocative perspectives on global events. Democracy Now!, weekdays at noon, right here on Radio Catskill.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we'll hear the jungle drums of Chico O'Farrell, Mr. Bongo live in Hollywood, and another weird cover version of Light My Fire. I'm Daryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour. Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Jeff, your host on Radio Catskill's new show, Electric Mountain. I play the best of dance music from back in the day to today, and every week I'll feature a guest DJ spinning a continuous set, bringing their unique style. Come dance with us on Electric Mountain each and every Saturday night, 12 to 2, exclusively on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Sad songs, but there's a time and a place. Sometimes I need a little bubble gum to keep up the pace. When I'm walking along with the sun on my face, I'm going bum, 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 bum.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno, and that is Dave Keener, the musician. He is helping put on a summer song swap this Friday from 7 to 9 at Rafters Tavern in Calicoon. It's a Songwriters in the Round show featuring a mix of local and New York City rock, alt, country, and Americana artists and songwriters, including the Poison Love duo, Karen Dahlstrom, Cliff Westfall, and Dave Keener. Joining us now is Dave Keener with more. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Tim. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So tell us about the Summer Song Swap. What is the Summer Song Swap, and how did it come about?
This is our show that's coming up on Friday, which you described very well. And it really came about because, you know, as human beings, we kind of need songs, you know? And the new Taylor Swift album only has 31 songs on it, so eventually it's going to run out. And that's why, fortunately, in our area, you know, Sullivan and Wayne County, we have a lot of good original songwriters to draw on. And I just wanted to put them all in one show where people can come in and, you know, with the songwriters just each taking turns doing a song. You'll see a whole bunch of good original songwriters from our area or, you know, who come through our area or live in our area.
Yeah.
In a short time.
Yeah, I'm just letting the listener know we're having a little bit of trouble on the line. It's kind of it's not your radio; it's the connection we have here. So when you're talking about a song swap, are you guys getting together and playing each other's music, or what's the swap part?
Right, swapping is taking turns. We're just each gonna, you know, someone's gonna, I'll introduce people, then, you know, maybe I'll do one, then the next person does one. It's kind of like just hanging out on the porch, you know, sharing music in kind of an old-fashioned way with each other, and just kind of like you'd have an audience of friends and family. That's the way we're going to do it. We're really just going to take turns playing our original song.
You describe yourself, you're a singer-songwriter, but you also host something called the Songwriter Death Match. Can you explain what that is?
Yeah.
and what does that mean? You've got your song swap and your song death match. So, you're good at hosting these things.
Yeah.
What's the death match?
Well, I can describe it quickly. So I wanted a more communal type of show. I know Deathmatch sounds not so communal, but I wanted a show where we got a bunch of musicians together instead of taking turns playing, taking turns with the audience, playing for an hour, one person. You know, how can I get songwriters together to play together, kind of like a traditional Irish music session? And so this is what I came up with, Songwriter Deathmatch. Songwriter Deathmatch is the sort of punk rock Brooklyn version of the summer song flop.
Okay.
I'm making it a little nicer. I have mellows. Sullivan County mellows me. And I think summer song flop is a better fit than Songwriter Deathmatch up here.
You had to go with the Brooklyn marketing there with Deathmatch, I guess, right?
Yeah.
We got to know you during our recent Tiny Porch concert and our music gathering here during our spring fun drive. Of course, you've been playing around the area for a while, but it all started when you were 14 and you borrowed a guitar from your aunt, according to your bio on DaveKeener.com. Can you tell folks about starting out and what drove you into your type of music?
Yeah, I had piano lessons. My brother and I did. And honestly, reading sheet music was a real barrier for me. I thought I didn't like playing music. But then when I picked up a guitar and saw you could kind of get there through chords, it made a lot of sense to me. And somehow it kind of just went right into writing. Me and even my friends, we were always like kind of writing either songs or we were sitting around a tape recorder and doing Monty Python bits or something. So it kind of came naturally for us to create stuff. And that's really how I started writing.
And you've recorded 4 solo albums. But as you say in your bio on the website, you like having a sharing the stage with other musicians instead of just performing solo. Why is that?
I've done it a long time, and I feel like you can make the show a little more communal, which is something I'm just looking for. I don't know. I guess, people in a band, they have a little more community experience. But as solo artists, we can really get siloed and be on our own. And this is a way for me to both, kind of make a little band out of solo artists. But also, I feel like this approach makes it better for the audience because the audience can see multiple songwriters. And maybe they'll have a better time because with multiple musicians bringing their fans and friends and all playing their best stuff, maybe it'll be a better show. I found that it actually is. People like the variety. We don't have the attention span so much for one person playing for an hour. This show makes it more of an event and I think more fun for the audience and the players.
And you like to have fun. You like to insert a little comedy into your music, including a series of music video covers of songs that you love called The Fake Book. Tell us about The Fake Book and some of the songs that you've performed.
Yeah, well, when jazz musicians sometimes, people playing cocktail hours and things, they kind of have a little book of sort of shortcuts for playing popular songs that they call a fake book. Just kind of has chords and words, and they improvise the rest. My fake book is just me recording songs that kind of struck me as, good songs that maybe a little odd in some way or a little odd when I do it. So I did, Copacabana by Barry Manilow, Something Stupid by Frank and Nancy Sinatra, and a few others. And it was a lot of fun. My wife and I were both temporarily unemployed at the time, and she's a TV person, so she helped me make these videos a lot better than I would make them.
Do you mind if I play a little bit of Copacabana for folks?
No, that'd be great.
Okay, here. Dave Keener.
Yeah, I can tell you a story. Got a minute? Her name was Lola. She was a showgirl with painted feathers in her hair and a dress cut down to there. She went.
I think people can appreciate your Tony Greer voice on the radio, but what they're missing in the video is your acting ability, which is amazing. You're picking up a phone and you're walking through the kitchen, like telling someone this story, and your your gesticulations are top notch. I'd say Emmy worthy right there. So I bet you guys had a lot of fun making these.
Yeah. They were fun. And my wife's got, she's hilarious. And we come up with these ways to shoot these things that are doable. And one way is to just be hammy on the screen for 3 minutes.
The song swap is coming up Friday at Rafters. Can you tell us a little bit about the folks that are going to be there as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. This is a great crew to start out with, but I'm confident we're going to have great crew every night because there's a lot of wealth of people to draw on. My friend Karen Dahlstrom, who has been on my Songwriter Deathmatch show a lot. She's a terrific Americana artist who writes a lot of great songs and has a beautiful voice. Then there's Cliff Westfall, a friend of mine. I think he's originally from Kentucky, and he loves the alt-country style. He's got these turns of phrase that'll just be like, wow, somebody just wrote a George Jones song in 2024, and it's just right. He's a lot of fun. And Poison Love Duo are people I know from the open mic at Raptors, Dan and Joanne. And they have a little more of, to me, it's kind of a classic rock style songwriting. It just brings a lot of her point of view into the music, and it's just fiddle and guitar. She does most of the writing, but he does the singing. So they're kind of a one-person singer-songwriter, mm-hmm. a two-person singer-songwriter, which is fun too. And he'll sing one of his original songs as well. And I'm also going to have our sound engineer for the next few weekends at Raptors is Dave Milner, who's a great singer-songwriter on his own. And he's got a new song out that I love called, what the heck is it called? Treading Water With You, that people should check out. But he's going to sneak up and do a song between his sound engineering duties.
And are you planning to do more of these swaps this summer or coming up?
Yeah, I would love to fit in at least another two in this area, hopefully at Rafters, if I can get on the schedule. It's pretty full, but I have this one, and maybe I can get another here and maybe one more somewhere else before the summer ends.
All right. The Summer Song Swap is Friday from 7 to 9 at Rafters in Calicoon, featuring Poison Love Duo, Karen Dahlstrom, Cliff Westfall, and Dave Keener, who we've been talking to. More information at rafterstavern.com. And Dave, thanks for joining us. Thanks for your music, which is really fun. I think we'll play a little bit more out. How about Put Me With the People from your PTO album?
That sounds great. I just want to say thank you so much. And everyone listening, please come on out. Give the show a try. We have a lot of good songwriters in the area. And I'm going to try to introduce them to you in a fun, fast-moving show.
All right. Dave Keener, thanks so much.
Some compromises and not just a few. To put some money in my hot little hand, have a home and family like I'd always planned. Now life ain't over, but it is over half done. A man can't help but think about the world to come. St. Peter, don't you put me with fools like me. Let me bring my guitar to eternity and put me with the people that play the rock and roll. With the people that play the rock and roll. Just count me in, I'll hold it down. I just wanna hear the angels play that crazy sound. Put me with the people.
That's Dave Keener. And we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, two local Girl Scouts on a mission of peace. This is Radio Chatskill.
On the next Radiolab,
we turn our gaze to the heavens.
A galactic enigma.
A strange,
whimsical,
crazy,
little weirdo.
An object.
The universe is more weird and wonderful than we thought.
Named?
Zuzve.
What?
Zuzve is one of these weird and wonderful things.
I've never heard of those.
But this is very, very, very unlikely to ever hit Earth.
That's on the next Radiolab.
This afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Hi, this is Marco Werman, host of The World. Weekdays at 3, our newsroom connects you with events around the globe. Our reporters in the Americas, Africa, Europe, and Asia get to the heart of the day's news. We bring you international perspectives on issues worldwide and here in the U.S. It's 1 hour each day that broadens horizons and takes you beyond our borders. Join me on The World, afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Katie Slemmer and Victoria Scutham are two local Girl Scouts on a mission of peace. They're placing a peace pole in the Calicoon Creek Park tomorrow during a ceremony. They joined us here yesterday to tell us more about what is a peace pole and how they came to place it in the park.
Well, I got the idea because my grandma gave me a garden peace pole last year. I looked up the information about the Peace Pole website with the United Nations, and I thought it would be a good idea for my Bronze Award project because there are not any peace poles in this area, even though we are near Woodstock, which is a place of peace.
So what is a peace pole?
It's a post with four sides, each saying, "May peace prevail on earth," in different languages.
The peace pole was created in 1955 in Japan by a woman named Masashi Goi. And the base, like the whole topic of the peace pole, is based on the bombings in Hiroshima and the wars that go on in Japan and all around the world. So the peace pole project started going around the world, and now there are over 250,000 peace poles all around the world.
That's amazing.
And the United States has 121 dedicated to that 250,000.
It's a large number, but it sounds like there should be some more in the U.S., and you guys are helping to get more. And so this is like an international thing. You found this on the United Nations website. How did you go about finding it?
Well, we heard about peace poles, and we saw one in Manatee Park in Florida, and we thought it would be a cool idea, and we looked it up.
And what is this bronze project we're talking about? Is this involved with the scouting?
Yeah.
Okay, so tell me about that. What do you guys have to do for this project?
Well, a bronze award is basically the highest award a junior can achieve, and it helps us learn leadership skills and how to make a difference in our community by doing something kind or helpful, or something that involves with the Girl Scout law. So that's basically what we do when we are on our last year of being a junior, because then when we turn into cadets and to the other years of the rest of our Girl Scouts, then
we'll work on the Silver Award.
Okay.
And then the Gold Award.
And then the Gold Award. That makes sense. So this is your bronze one. Tell me what goes into creating this peace pole. You found this great idea, and how did you get it to become something that's going to get dedicated?
You have to come up with the idea and then put it to action. So I came up with the idea, and then I talked to my troop about it and asked if they were willing to help me, and they said yes. So I went to the town board and to get approval, and they approved it.
The town of Delaware, which is the for Calicoon, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so you had to go to the town board to get approval. Were you intimidated by that at all?
Not really.
So when you went to the town board, what did you bring with you to show them that you wanted to do this, like examples?
I bought a few printed out slides and showed them where I would put it.
Uh-huh. And what did they say?
And they said, yeah.
Okay, that's easy. That's good. There's project done. Check. But instead, you got the approval, but you still have to get it produced and put into the park. What's involved with that? Who's doing that?
Well, me and my parents and maybe some of the troop will help us. And we just dig a hole and we put it in the ground.
Okay. So it's as easy as digging a hole. But there's a little ceremony around it, right?
Yeah.
Can you tell me about the ceremony that's happening?
So we are singing a couple of songs that involve peace. And the songs are basically, it's the same type of topic of the peace pole, because they're all involve peace, and it's an awareness that even though there's a lot of war going on, there is still peace and it can still prevail.
Is that important to you guys as young people to be able to show this peace pole there with all the chaos and conflict in the world? I mean, besides just being a project that you're completing for the Scouts, it's something that sounds like it's kind of personal to you.
I mean, it might not be personal to some girls in the Girl Scout troop, even though we're not very involved in each other's personal lives. But I do know that a lot of people out there are affected by these wars personally and mentally and physically.
So what do you hope the Peace Pole will do to help people come to a better understanding?
It will tell people more about, like, how even though there's a lot of things going on, we can still have peace and we can still be nice and everything.
The Peace Pole is a representation of all of that.
Yes.
Congratulations to you guys for getting this together. I mean, some people don't even think about that. They think about maybe peace in the world or it's a saying, but you guys really are doing something to manifest and put this into action, as you said.
Yeah.
Who's going to be at the ceremony? Are there going to be officials?
Well, the town board's going to be there and the whole Girl Scout troop.
Or the kids who can make it.
We invited some of the donors that donated the supplies that we needed. Calicoon Supply and Agway donated a lot of them.
And is anyone invited to attend?
Anyone
that wants to come can come. It's a ceremony open to the public.
Oh, great. So tell me and tell everybody what the time is and where they should go.
So
it's on May 30th at 6:30 p.m.
In Calicoon Creek Park.
Right there on the banks of the Calicoon Creek by the Delaware River.
Yes.
You can't miss it. It's a big pole that says peace.
May peace prevail on Earth.
May peace prevail on Earth. So what's next? The UN?
The UN?
You guys might have a career in diplomacy or something here. Thank you guys so much. We appreciate you bringing this to the community and bringing this to us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
That's Victoria Scootham and Katie Slemmer, two local scouts who want you to think, speak, and act in the spirit of peace and harmony. That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can find the program and all of our local programs on our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Aaron Bendich. Join me for Borscht Beat, the Jewish music show on Radio Catskill. Each week I share rare, forgotten, and classic recordings from Jewish musical traditions across multiple generations, from Yiddish folk songs to instrumental klezmer, Yiddish theater, and contemporary performances. It's a grand tour of many musical landscapes. That's Borscht Beat, an hour of Jewish music in the Catskills, Sunday afternoons at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Last year, over 100,000 people died from drug overdoses driven by fentanyl. And the fastest growing group is under 19. Fentanyl is the number one cause of overdose in Sullivan County. Whether you're a parent or an educator, you can have the right conversation now to potentially save a kid's life. Protect kids from the dangers of fentanyl. More information and resources at naturalhigh.org. Paid for by Catholic Charities of Orange, Sullivan, and Ulster.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. Today's forecast for the listening area, cloudy with a potential of an afternoon thunderstorm, high 69. Tonight's low around 50. Partly sunny tomorrow, high 68. And looking ahead, Friday, Saturday, looking sunny and pleasant, high in the near 70 to 75, some showers on Sunday. It's 11 o'clock.